We're in the 10th and 11th chapters of Hosea. I studied this morning. Let me go back and look at just one thought in the last chapter, chapter 9. Now, I don't think I dealt very thoroughly with this. Now, the last verse, verse 17, "My God will cast them away because they did not hearken unto him, and they shall be wanderers among the nations." Well, that's been fulfilled, hasn't it? The northern tribe of Israel and the Jews also of Judah are wanderers among the nations. Now, they do have a little nation over in Palestine now. There's not anything like what was destroyed. And Jews are scattered throughout the earth. But there's another passage I've called attention to a number of times. I think we ought always to remember. God said in Jeremiah 30 and verse 11, "I will bring to an end all the nations where I scattered thee, but I will not bring thee to a full end, but will chastise thee," and so on. God never brought the Jews to a full end. Those nations where they were scattered cannot identify themselves with the nations of today cannot clearly identify themselves with the nations that God destroyed back yonder. But the Jew can. Wherever the Jew lives today, he lives as an individual, as a Jew, and still so recognized. So the people were never destroyed as a people. They were completely destroyed as a nation. They would be wanderers throughout the earth, and are and have been throughout all this time. So when you look at these passages, I think it's very strong evidence for the inspiration of the Bible that only a divine or an infinite spirit or person could determine or declare the future destiny of nations and his own people, and these stand out as individuals, whereas the others are scattered, and these are wanderers throughout the earth today. So, and really they're never at home anywhere, although they're citizens of the United States or citizens of Russia. Wherever they are, they never seem to be at home. They never seem to fit in with a society. They're a distinct people, always have been, always will be, but they're not God's people anymore. They're God's witness. Now, Isaiah said at a number of times, "And ye are my witnesses." Well, the Jews are still witnesses to the fact that God was their God and they were his people, and that what God said about them was true. So they're still his witnesses, though not intentionally, but they are nevertheless. I think all of that makes the Bible a very fascinating book and makes our confidence in it as the Word of God very solid. Because only God could have said those things. Well, that brings to chapter 10 now. Israel is a luxuriant vine that that putteth forth his fruit. According to the abundance of his fruit, he hath multiplied his altars. According to the goodness of their land, they have made goodly pillars. That is, beautiful pillars. Right? Now, a luxuriant vine, that is, the word Ephraim, as I said last Sunday morning, means double fruit. Double fruit, that's its meaning. Well, it was going to become, instead of double fruit, double destruction. Double nothing, having nothing there. They would be, it would still be a double there. We pointed that out last time there. What was going to happen to them in verse 16, "Smitten, their root is dried up, they shall bear no fruit. Yea, though they bring forth, yet will I slay the beloved fruit of their womb." In other words, from double fruit to now no fruit. Double destruction. All right, so here he said, but here's what I want you to know. Though he was a luxuriant vine and should have spread out and borne great fruit for the Lord, yet he bore no fruit. Why? Because they turned to idolatry. They left the Lord there. So, but now that he's multiplied altars, as he multiplied the fruit, and multiplied these altars for the idols to whom they attributed these blessings. They said that their blessing came from the Balaam. That's Baal plural. And now they've made goodly pillars as obelisks there, monuments to these various idols there. And I mentioned time or two. I know it wasn't Palestine, but once. But I remember we visited one place. It slipped my memory now where it was. One of the old Canaanite cities. There down at a certain place, they had a whole lot of those obelisks set up there that they had back in those days. And I came to understand better what they meant about these pillars. They were monuments set up to these idol gods there. And that's what he's talking about here. Now, so their heart is divided. That is, he has divided their heart, God has, but whether he has or they have or the idols have, the heart was divided. Their heart is divided. Now shall they be found guilty. He will smite their pillars, that is, altar, their God will. He will destroy their pillars. Now, these things they set up to these idol gods, God would destroy all of these. Now, he used the Assyrians to do that and others. Now, surely now shall they say, we have no king, for we fear not Jehovah, and the king, what can he do for us? Now, this is 750 to 725. They were carried away in captivity in 722. The siege began somewhere about 725 against Samaria. So you can see you're getting toward the close of their history, their period there in Samaria or in the north there as Israel. Right? So they say, what can the king do for us? He's helpless. And we've rejected God. So what do we have to look to? Nothing. Nothing at all. They speak vain words, swearing falsely in making covenants. Therefore judgment springeth up as hemlock in the furrows of the field. Now, that is let me read a little bit farther. The inhabitants of Samaria shall be in terror for the calves of Beth Aven, for the people thereof shall moan over it, and the priests thereof that rejoice over it for the glory thereof, because it is departed from it, is carried away. It also shall be carried into Assyria for a present to King Ajarab. Ephraim shall receive shame, and Israel shall be ashamed of his own counsel. Now let's look at that for just a moment now. First of all, they speak vainly. Ephraim, the leaders, the rulers, they tried to make an alliance with Assyria. They'd made that. Well, God expects a nation, when it makes a treaty with another nation, to keep that treaty, to honor the covenant that he made. He expects that of individuals. Thou vowest to vow unto Jehovah, depart not to pay it. We have no pleasure in fools. Pay that which thou vowest. So this is a very serious thing, to make a covenant or make a treaty or enter into a vow or a covenant, a treaty with another individual or a nation. Now notice he says, therefore judgment, that is the condemnation or judgment, shall spring up as hemlock in the furrows of the field. Now the hemlock was a poisonous herb from which they made a poisonous drink, as you recall, and would drink that in committing suicide. Right? So now then, this judgment is going to be a bitter, it's going to be as poison unto them. That judgment is going to be that. The inhabitants of Samaria shall be in terror for the calves of Beth Aven. Now Beth El was house of God. Beth Aven, house of vanity. Beth was house. Bethlehem was the house of bread. So you have the word Beth before another part of this word there. It means the house of something. So the house of God, Bethel, house of vanity, Beth Aven, Bethlehem, house of bread, so on there. All right? For the people thereof shall mourn over it, and the priests thereof. Now these priests are the Chimerim, it says over here. Now these would be the priests of the idols. Now let me look at that Chimerim, if I move more in 2 Kings 23 and 5. And there we get the meaning of that. 2 Kings 23 and verse 5 there, on this Chimerium, they are told there what they were. About 23:5 here. And he put down the idolatrous priest, and the word there, the Camerum, he put down the idolatrous priest whom the kings of Judah had ordained to burn incense in the high places, in the cities of Judah and in the places about Jerusalem. So these Camerum, he talks about here, they were the priests of these idols. So from 2 Kings and also from Zechariah, you have the word used again there. Well, we understand what he's talking about here. Now the priest, now that would be the Camerum, the priest of these idols, thereof, that rejoiced over it, that is over this calf in Bethel, for the glory thereof, because it is departed from it. That is, the glory is departed. That idol that you'd set up, that golden calf, Jeroboam the first is set up in one in Bethel, one in Dan. So now then, that these, the idolatry is bringing them to destruction, now they no longer rejoice over it, over that idol. It also shall be carried into Assyria, that is the one at Bethel, which he's talking about here, shall be carried into Assyria for a present to King Jareb. That it meant King Combat. I don't know if there's ever a king by that name, but we have it twice here in, we had it before, back in the 5th chapter, I believe, here in Hosea, King Jareb, referring here to the king of Assyria, who is King Combat, King Destroyer, whatever other interpretations of the word there. But it was not, I don't think it was a personal pronoun. I think it was simply a word used by him of the king of Assyria, what he was going to do. All right, King Jareb, Ephraim shall receive shame, and Israel shall be ashamed of his own counsel, of the counsel that they listened to when they listened to the counsel there of Jeroboam the first in setting up these calves, and then the counsel that kings ever since as it guided them in idolatry. Now, I made this statement before, but that you might remember it. There was never a faithful king in northern Israel in the whole 2 or 3 or 4 years that it existed. They were all idolaters. All of them worshipped the calves, or some of them even went farther and worshipped the Balaam of the Canaanites. Well, all right. Now, as for Samaria, her king is cut off as foam upon the water, or as twigs upon the water, whatever it might be. Well, anyway, here's foam. Let's say you use the word foam. You had a foam upon the water. What happens? It evaporates. It destroys. It's gone. Well, they're going to be like that now. Notice Samaria, her king, is cut off as foam, that is, as nothing, and as that foam that evaporates and is gone upon the water. The high places also, now there's the king, and here the high places, also in Avon, that is vanity, the sin of Israel, that was their sin, was idolatry, shall be destroyed. The thorn and the thistle shall come up on their altars, and they shall say to the mountains, cover. Now therefore, I think I remember correctly, I think it's in the 23rd chapter of the book of Luke that we have that expression there. I should have had this in my mind better. Let's see. Oh yeah, verse 30, when he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, then shall they begin to say to the mountains, fall on us, and to the hills, cover us. For if they do these things in the green tree, what shall they do in the dry? And so I'm trying to identify what this means. It's a figure of speech meaning cover us from what's before us. Now you also have it over in the 6th chapter of the book of Revelation. And I'd like to read that also, if I can remember where it is or find it. And right in the 6th chapter of Revelation here, we're talking here about, I'm going to get my other Bible. This one here is such bad shape I can't find anything in it anymore.
Verse 16
and 16. Now notice what it says here. verse, begin with verse 15, and the strong and every bondman and every shall hid themselves in the caves and in the rocks of the mountains, and they say before God, this, I'm not going to have to read that, I believe, and they say to the mountains and to the rocks, fall on us, and hide us from the face of him that sitteth on the throne, and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath is come, and who is able to stand it? Now, we generally read that and think of that as the final coming of the Lord. No, that's not necessarily so. I think it will be then, if they have the time. But this is talking about when men, the judgment of God, falls upon men. Then they cry to the mountains to fall on, the rocks to hide us from the face of the wrath of God. That's in any time of wrath. And so from these three instances, back over here in Hosea, and here in Jesus in Luke, and John in Revelation, now the expression does not refer to the final day of judgment, but it refers to any day in which God's wrath is poured out, and people try to flee from it, but can't. And so it may come to a nation when it's being invaded and destroyed. Let the rocks cover us and hide us. But when we've sinned against God and God's judgment is executed, there's not going to be a place to hide. No place to hide. They're going to be with us the same way when a judgment hits this country. Now, I read from one of the brethren in one of the papers the other day. He was feeling encouraged. He's finding that more young people are reading the Bible, more young people are praying privately and all that. Well, he sees something that I don't see. I may see a kind of a turning to religion, but it's a religion after their own devising and not a concern for the Bible to find out what God's will is in it. I don't want to be a pessimist, yet I am a little pessimistic. It helped of the old cry for them to hide Israel. Now, that's a difficult passage. If you read the different commentaries, they have many different views of it. What it seems to be, Gibeah, I mentioned that before back in Joshua, when the Benjamites there, when they destroyed that girl, that woman, the concubine of the priest going through there, and so they came together there and destroyed some over 20,000 of them, all the men except 600, so they were not completely destroyed. But now then, it's not going to be just like that in this battle when God brings the wrath against Israel. There's not going to be 600 of them left to carry on as a nation. The nation's going to be completely destroyed. That's the point there. So it's going to be different. Now that was almost destroyed back then, but wasn't. But shall overtake them in Gibeah. When it is my desire, I will chastise them, and the people shall be gathered against them, when they are bound to their two transgressions. Now that's another difficulty. What are these two transgressions? Well, there are a number of commentaries on that. And I got a number of ideas from it. All of them are different. Jeremiah said in Jeremiah 2:13, my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewed themselves cisterns, broken cisterns, which can hold no water. So some think it's like that. It's in forsaking God and building idols. That could be correct. Then there were other ideas. Then there's the idea that it was the forsaken the house of David and set up your own king, and you've forsaken God and set up your idols. That's very probable, very likely. Or it could be you've forsaken me as your king. Back on in 1 Samuel 8, when they asked for a king, rejected Jehovah, and now you've rejected me as your God. So the two transgressions, I think, although I'm not sure, I think the two transgressions are, you have rejected me as your king, and you've rejected me as your God. What do you have left? So, but you can take any one of those, could be correct. And there may be others that you think of. But there were two transgressions, and I know that God, I think that God is king and God is God. Maybe they would be my choice of the ones I've suggested. There could be those others. Because when you reject God as king, you rejected the house of David. When you're, I mean, that which he had set up, you rejected that, all right, but you rejected God in that. And when you reject God for idols, when you turn to idolatry, you rejected him as that. So you see, seems to me that the idea, they've rejected me as their king, they've rejected me as their God. So now then, for these two transgressions, why, you're bound. And so they set up their own puppet kings there. So puppet kings and puppet gods that'll do what you want done always lead to destruction. All right. When is my desire there? All right, your two transgressions. And Ephraim is a heifer that is taught, that loveth to tread out the grain. But I passed over upon her the fair neck. I will set a rider on Ephraim. Judah shall plow. Jacob shall break their clods. In other words, I'm going to bring you into a captivity here now, where you like to thrash the grain, you tribute your good crops to your idols, your gods. But now then God said, I'm going to pass over a fair neck. I'm going to put a yoke upon her. I'm going to put a rider on her. And she's going to do that which she doesn't want to do, Ephraim is. You thought that. So all of this is what? All of this is saying that Ephraim's idolatry and rejection of God as a king, the one to look to, set up their puppet kings, and their rejection of God as God, is going to bring this inevitable result. And that will be your destruction. So wild oats here. I don't have that. Nobody knows where it was. And so we don't know where it was in the day of battle. The mother was dashed in pieces with her children. So shall Beth El do unto you because of your great wickedness. At daybreak shall the king of Israel be utterly cut off. Now look here at this. Now here, that was destroyed. I know how to destroy them. And I read one other passage in the Old Testament where, in destroying a city, they dash the little ones against the wall. Well, they take the little one, dash them, and kill them that way. There, kill the women. You remember how that Ammonites, when they invaded Gilead, there, they ripped up the women with child to watch the fetus fall out on the ground. There, all that. War brings out, I guess, the worst in people. Sometimes it brings out the best. Sometimes individuals will be helpful and brings out the best in them. But war as a whole brings out the worst in individuals. We've read some of us about that in the Philippines there, when they were driving carrying those captive Japanese through there, how did they kill one here and you want to get rid of them? By the time we got to the end of it, wasn't many of them left there. Well, you can understand the fellow in a war there when he's tense and undefined himself and how he's treated and all that. And he loses all sense of anything good. Now, yet, you saw the pictures of those soldiers in Arabia there, over there, that when the soldiers did give up and come out, why, the American soldier was good to them, they fed them, tended to their wounds and their sores and all that. So as I say, it'll bring out the best, it'll bring out the worst in people, war does. And so we'll see that here. But anyway, the point is here, as the dash, so shall Bethel do unto you because of your great wickedness. At daybreak shall the king of Israel be utterly cut off. Daybreak, that is when it looks like the dawn of a better day. Instead of that, the king will be cut off. So instead of it, the dawn indicating a new day, continues dark. He's cut off. Well, terrible picture, isn't it? Terrible picture. But it, folks, what's it teaching us? The consequence of sin, the inevitable harvest of sin. It's inevitable what it'll bring back. Can't bring anything else. Wickedness and sin are going to produce just what we're having, ultimate destruction. So that's why we have to be very careful that we contribute our part to the good. All right, now comes a quotation found in the New Testament. When Israel was a child, then I loved him and called my son out of Egypt. Now that's quoted in the New Testament, and in Matthew 2 and verse 15, where when Joseph and Mary took Jesus, little baby Jesus, down into Egypt, that God might call his son out of Egypt. Now, this really is not a messianic prophecy. What it means, and it was quoted in the New Testament, it's a parallel. Now, there are some prophecies that are fulfilled in a parallel sense. Now, God carried his people down into Egypt to escape the idolatry of Canaan, where there they were for a while, and God called them out. What? God carried his son Jesus into Egypt during the wrath of Herod, and then called him out of Egypt because the time of wrath was past now. So it's simply a prophecy fulfilled in parallel, and not necessarily in a direct fulfillment in that the prophecy looked unto it, if I make myself clear. So the prophecy wasn't looking unto Jesus coming out of Egypt, but Jesus coming out of Egypt fulfilled a parallel to that. And they were carried down for protection and brought back later. They were carried down to protect them from idolatry, then brought out as a nation of people of God. See the parallel? Well, I think that's the idea of it. Right? Now, the more the prophets called them, the more they went from them, went from what God said. They sacrificed under the Balaam and burned incense to graven images. So the prophets were trying to call them back. I don't know how many prophets they had up there in that country. You had Elijah, you had Elisha. They were not writing prophets, but they were prophets of Israel up there. And of course you have Amos and you have Obadiah and those. They might have had some reference to that too. But anyway, they didn't listen to the prophets. That's the point. Yet I taught Ephraim to walk. I took them on my arms, but they knew not that I healed them. I drew them with cords of a man, with bands of love, and I was to them as they that lift up the yoke on their jaws, and I laid food before them. Now let's look at that. To me, that's a very beautiful and a very touching scene. Here is a picture of, here is a man and a little boy. He holds him by the hands and teaches him to walk, and then turns him loose, tells him to come. You can just see the love of the Father in that. All right? Then he stumbles, then the Father takes him up in his arms, holds him close to his heart here, and comforts him in that. Well, that's what God has done. Here, when you were as an infant nation of people, I took you by the hands. I taught you to walk. When you stumbled, I picked you up and brought you close to my heart. But what did I get in return? Ingratitude, idolatry, turning from me, rejection of me. See the picture? I want you to see it. It's a picture. We've had the picture of God's wrath in destroying them now. Here we have a picture of his love and his effort to try to make the kind of people he wanted to out of them, but he wouldn't let him. Wouldn't let him. Right, and so he says then, and I drew them with cords of a man, with bands of love, and I was to them as they that lift up the yoke on the ox. Now here the ox is working, and you lift up the yoke there and set food before, fodder before the ox there. Well, God has done that. I've lifted the yoke off of you, the bondage. I've set everything good before you. When I give you this land, what have I received in return? I received your mistreatment, your disregard, turning your back on me, and all of that. So it's a beautiful picture from God's point of view. So you see, you get the two sides. Always remember this, class, that there are two sides to God's actions toward people. When I think of God's two sides, I know I've tried to preach on that, but once, many years ago, I tried to preach on Nahum, the first chapter, in verse about 7-8, I want you to look at it for just a moment. Here in this chapter here, God is pointing out his wrath against his enemies. And like a whirlwind and a storm will he destroy them. But look at verse 7. Jehovah is good, a stronghold in the day of trouble, and he knoweth them that take refuge in him. But with an overflowing flood, he will make a full end of a place and will pursue his enemies into darkness. There are the two sides. Jehovah is good. Jehovah is kind. He's loving, tender. But on the other hand, here's the wrath of God. So when we talk about God is love, that's right. God is. He's the very epitome of it. But when you look at God in his reality and what he is, then here's the other side. You're the God of wrath against sin. His righteousness and brings them to hate sin. So this is what the prophets are trying to point out. Both sides. And I think Hosea does that in a very excellent way. Now notice verse 5. They shall not return into the land of Egypt, but the Assyrian shall be their king, because they refused to return to me. Because they didn't give to me, they turned from me. Now back in the 8th chapter, and I think about verse 13 or somewhere along there. Here's where God, 13. Jehovah accepteth them not. Now will he remember their iniquity and visit their sins. They shall return to Egypt. Remember I said when I mentioned that, it would not be Egypt, it would be Assyria. Egypt was a symbol of bondage. Now, so that's what it is there, the symbol of bondage. Now, and you've got it also in the 9th chapter, in verse 3, back here, when he says there, they shall not return in, they shall not dwell in Jehovah's land, but Ephraim shall return to Egypt, and they shall eat unclean bread in Assyria. So there he's introducing the idea. Now here's where he makes it complete here, when he says in this one, this passage here, that they shall not return unto the land of Egypt, but the Assyrian shall be their king, for they refuse to return to me. So Egypt is the symbol of bondage. Assyria is the reality. It's the literal place of that bondage. So we have both the symbolic and the literal in that passage there. The symbolic of Egypt and the literal Assyria. I think you ought to mark that to remember that one. And the sword shall fall upon their cities and shall consume their bars, and the bars that protect them, the bars of the gates, and devour them because of their own counsel. And what's this brought, what brought this about? Their own counsel, not giving, listening to God, but following their own ideas. All right? Now that same thing happened to this country. Let's look at capital punishment for a moment. Now that's an outlawed thing almost in this country. You let us have a, put a man to death here, and the ACLU just throws a fit there. Okay? That ACLU is nothing but an atheistic, humanistic organization. I think it's one of the great curses of America. I despise it myself because of what it stands for and what it is. But at any rate, now what do we listen to? Our own counsel. What are the counsel to which we've listened in this country? Turn the criminal, just put the criminal in jail, give him a television, keep it air conditioned, good food, and let the country support him as long as he lives there for a few years, and turn him loose on society again. What's God's counsel? God's counsel is, whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God made he him. Who are we going to listen to? Who are we listening to? We're listening to the ACLU, the atheists, rather than to God, the ruler. Well, what's going to happen? Same thing happened to them, because they listened to their own counsel. My people are bent on backsliding from me, though they call them to him that is on, they call them to him that is on high, none at all will exalt him. That is, now then, they call them, that is the prophets. Prophets call them to him that is on high, but none will listen to him. So here the prophets are calling to them, but they are not listening. Word of God's calling today, nobody listening to it. In fact, we are not herald, we're not sounding it very loud. We're not, I feel all of us who claim to be preachers and evangelists, I think we've let the Lord down in my generation. I think we've been content to hold our preaching as a job, a position, to preach to four walls and a few people who come to it that are already in agreement with him, and we're not having much effect in our country, on the country, the thinking of the people today. And I think that we'll be held responsible also for our failure in this. Now here's one of the most sympathetic, most touching passages in the whole book. How shall I give thee up, Ephraim? How shall I cast thee off, Israel? How shall I make thee as Admah? How shall I make thee a Zeboim? My heart is turned within me. My compassions are kindled together. I will not execute the fierceness of mine anger. I will not return to destroy Ephraim, for I am God and not man, the Holy One in the midst of thee, and I will not come in wrath. They shall walk after Jehovah, who will roar like a lion. For he shall roar, and the children shall come trembling from the west. They shall come trembling as a bird out of Egypt, and as a dove out of the land of Assyria. And I will make them to dwell in their houses, saith Jehovah. Now let's analyze that. How shall I give thee up? Can't you just hear God? How shall I give you up? How shall I reject you? You've been my son. Look at what I've done for you. How shall I make thee as Admah? Now Admah and Zeboim were two cities near Sodom and Gomorrah that were destroyed with Sodom and Gomorrah. The actual sites of ancient Sodom and Gomorrah, Zeboim and this other one here, Admah, haven't been found. They think they found where they're diving down in the Dead Sea at one end. They think they found the remains of maybe Sodom and Gomorrah, but they're not sure. They don't know that. So they haven't found. God so completely destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah that no vestige of it left. So also Zeboim and the other. Now God said, I'm not going to do you that bad. To be a God and not man. You must always remember that difference. I am God and not man. Right now, how am I going to harmonize this? The point is, I'll not utterly, there'll still be a few stragglers. There'll be a few. I said last Sunday night on the book of Luke, first chapter of Luke, that we have Anna mentioned there as a daughter of Asher, descendant of Asher. So whether there were others, I don't know. She's the only one that's named in the New Testament. The only tribe named there. But at any rate, the point is here that they're going to be scattered everywhere among all the nations. But I remember that passage. But I'll call them and they'll come trembling, but they'll be one at a time as they obey the gospel. They'll come to the God in that. It'll not be as a nation that he destroyed there. And this is the point here. I'm the hope God, the Holy One, and not man, in the midst of thee, and I will not come in wrath. That is, enter into the city with wrath. That is, and I'll destroy them with wrath again. We know that. But the city itself will never be destroyed. Well, the Roman Empire tried to destroy it, and atheism, infidelity, and all humanism tried to destroy it ever since. But it still exists. There'll always be a remnant. They will always be children of God. When Jesus Christ comes again, he says, the dead will be raised first, and they that are left shall be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, and be caught up together to meet the Lord in the air. So shall ever be with the Lord. There will always be a remnant. Well, in Revelation, the 20th chapter, when the devil is loosed for a little time, gathers together Gog and Magog, he comes up against the camp of the saints. So there's still a camp. Not a big army, not a big anything. Sort of a camp compared to everything. All these nations come up against it. I think we're living in that time right now. I think Satan has gathered together the forces of Gog and Magog. That's your forces of atheism, communism, humanism, hedonism, all of those different isms. Whatever they may be, they're contrary to God. He's using all these forces today in an effort to destroy that which pertains to God. We can see it on every hand, can't we? The effort of Satan today. All right? But there'll still be a remnant or camp when the Lord comes back. There'll be a few. So the devil gathers thee and he comes up against the camp, and it's a small group right now. It's more or less of a camp. Maybe we're just sort of camping out instead of fighting the battle. I don't know which. But at any rate, we've got all of this, and the devil's against it. Well, that's, I think, what he's talking about. There. And so let me look at that last thought there. They shall come trembling as a bird out of Egypt and as a dove out of the land of Assyria, and I will make them to dwell in their houses, saith Jehovah. In my father's house are many mansions, many abiding places. If not so, I would have told you. Each of us abides in his abiding place in the Lord, which I favor with him now. our close relation to him now. Now the next verse here is the beginning of, the chapter shouldn't have ended here, it should have ended in verse 11. Ephraim compasseth me about falsehood, and the house of Israel with deceit, but Judah yet ruleth. I want to talk about that, but I don't think he does. I think Judah is yet unsteadfast. I think the alternate reading is the best. I'll take that up next time. Do I have a question from anybody? Anybody have a question you want to ask? Anybody wants to got anything you want to add to what I've said? You want to say about it? As I never have learned how to teach yet. I'm teaching for 60 years, never have learned to teach in a way to draw people out. I never could do it. I guess because I do so much talking myself, they said, well, you don't give us much of a chance. And my boys used to tell me, Dad, said, you look up and say, anybody have a question? And you look down here and you go around. Long if anybody had one, you wouldn't know anything about it. But maybe that's right.
Comment on the teacher.
Sir?
You answer all the questions.
Well, maybe, all right. Well, maybe it's, maybe that's it. Maybe it's something up. Anyhow, I got into that habit in college because when I let my students talk, they want to get me off on this line, I thought I know on something else. Get off the lesson before they didn't know what they didn't know it. So they didn't want to get me off of it. Well, I learned not to let them get me off, so they went on to be talking myself. If they had a question, I'd let them ask the question, but it had to be a question pertaining to what we're talking about. Well, we'll leave it there. Go back and read that sometimes and think on it and try to see not just the United States, not just any particular people. Try to see God in this passage, probably the two chapters. Try to see God in the book. God in society today. God at work today. God is still making history. He's still in history as he was back then. So try to see him and the principles on which he has always acted. Since he doesn't change, you can conclude what? He's still acting by the same principles.